This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and the places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiotakis. Today in Sun Valley, a neighborhood of the city of Los Angeles, nestled up against the foothills of the Verdugo Mountains at the eastern edge of the San Fernando Valley. And all around is a gathering of every kind of plant that's native to Southern California, from hummingbird sage and lilac verbena to deer grass and lemonade berry. Native plants are vital to the health of the local ecosystem, particularly during a time of climate change, which means, of course, hotter weather, droughts, which we're in right now, despite the rain that we're seeing today. And the Theodore Payne Foundation is a huge resource for finding locally native plants, plants that are indigenous to Southern California, as well as information about how and when to plant and to look after those plants after they're in the ground. Evan Meyer is the executive director here at Theodore Payne, and thank you for inviting us and being a part of this.
Thanks for being here. It's planting season, so it's a great time for you all to come out.
Well, this is the reason why I'm here, because we're planting now. For people who are interested in native plants, like the people who are like, I want things in my yard or things around me that are native to Southern California that will survive this pretty dramatic climate.
Dramatic. Well put.
Yeah, right? I mean, yes. Because we don't know what's to come, but we certainly know how the climate has been.
Right, and we know that we are in a Mediterranean climate, which means we have these wet, hopefully, winters, and we have hot, dry summers. So there's a seasonal drought. Every year we have a drought in Southern California. Now we're in a drought on top of that, where the winter we're not getting rain. So California native plants give you the option of syncing up with the seasons and having your garden work in harmony with the climate. And through that practice, we can save a whole lot of water and use that for other purposes.
Can you plant a garden with these kinds of plants and say, all right, I don't have to worry about watering them because they're supposed to be here?
Well, that's something that everybody assumes, that native plants means they take no effort to begin with. And we always say the most important thing with native plants is the establishment phase. So you want to pick the right time. And right now, in early fall, heading through all the fall into the winter, that's the ideal establishment time. Because what you're allowing the plant to do is grow a deep taproot. And that way it's going to reach that deep subterranean water. And that way it can kind of make it through that dry summer.
So you got to dig deep.
Well, you plant the plant now and it does the work for you. The root digs itself down. It goes down to the water. And one of the things that's nice about these plants is they're adapted for deep, infrequent waterings. So if you think of your typical landscape in Southern California, maybe you have a little bit of lawn, maybe some rose bushes. Those are usually running on a timed sprinkler system that goes a couple times a week. What California native plants need is actually just a deep watering, maybe every 10 days, 2 weeks. And if you get that through the first year of those plants, you can almost completely wean them off. And we see lots of people who don't water at all through the summer or just have very limited watering in a dry winter.
We know what kind of plants and vegetation you guys sell. But like if I were to go down the street to Home Depot or to Lowe's or Armstrong or wherever it may be, they're not selling the same kind of plants. And is that a problem, do you think?
Well, we think that native plants give Southern Californians the opportunity to rebuild nature in addition to saving water. And that's the real difference between native plants and your more broad category of drought-tolerant plants, is that the native plants have evolved with the native insects, the native birds, all the other native animal species that live here. So when you choose these plants, you're creating habitat for hummingbirds, you're creating habitat for butterflies, and you're actually restoring a natural system and bringing that back into our urban core. So that's kind of the big difference, and that's why we think that these plants should be much more prevalent.
There's a happy bird in the distance.
Yeah, see? I mean, you can hear it, right?
He's like, I really like this vegetation you have here, right?
Yeah, yeah. We build it, they will come. We've built their home for them.
Shall we take a look at a few plants?
Sure.
All right, let's move.
Great, let's go see some plants. So here we have a narrow-leaf milkweed. It's kind of reaching the end of its season. And you can see these are the dried up fruits here.
Oh, wow.
These little seeds will actually blow off in the wind.
And plant more milkweed.
And this is the host plant for the monarch caterpillar. So this, if you want monarch caterpillars, this is the plant you want.
This is what they love.
This is what they love.
Feed on.
This is what they need.
Yeah.
They can't live without this plant. This one is the one that is probably the easiest to grow, the narrow leaf milkweed. There's been a lot of talk recently about which type of milkweed to plant. And so we always recommend the native milkweed because that's the type of milkweed that the monarchs have evolved with. If you plant the tropical milkweed, which you'll see for sale, the seasonality is different, so it throws off their migratory cycle.
When you say the monarchs need this, do they need the milkweed as caterpillars? Do they need them as butterflies?
So primarily as caterpillars. This is their main food source, and they will form their chrysalis, which is the transition from caterpillar to butterfly.
This is the cocoon, right?
This is the cocoon, yeah. Which is really fun. I have a five-year-old. We get to watch that. That is an amazing thing to observe, that whole life cycle. But the monarch caterpillars cannot survive without milkweed plants around.
What about the bees?
Yes, so
the bees, you know, they pollinate.
Bees pollinate.
it's what they do.
I mean, if you like to eat any fruits, you probably like bees because all of our fruits come, and many of our vegetables, which are botanically fruits, come from bee pollination. So without bees, we don't have strawberries. We don't have blueberries. We don't have many of the foods that we eat every day. Native plants are exceptional at providing nectar for bees. So that's one of the big reasons to plant them. And they don't only support the European honeybee, which is the common bee that people think of. They support the many, many species of native bee. So bees are a very diverse group of organisms. There are hundreds of different species of bees native to California. And some of them live in the ground. Some of them live in holes in wood. They all are united by the fact that the best habitat that you can create for them is through California native plant landscape.
And because it's now the beginning of the wet season, it's the beginning of the planting season, right? I mean, you want to get the vegetation in the ground so it can get this water.
Exactly, yeah. And we are full of plants because of the time of year we're in. It's the planting season. Our big fall planting sale starts on Tuesday. We're really excited. And if you look, all of our plants have these placards, which are going to tell you exactly what you need to know to be
Dana
successful.
Point, California buckwheat.
Dana Point, California buckwheat. And it's going to tell you, how big is it going to be? What type of sun exposure? Does it like full sun? Does it like shade? How much water does it need? What kind of soil is it going to thrive in?
So there's a graphic for a butterfly and a deer.
Yep.
And a mountain, I think that is, and it says clay.
So clay is telling you that it can survive in clay soil. The butterfly there is telling you that it attracts butterflies. The deer is saying it's deer resistant, because that's a big problem, is a lot of times deer will come in and eat your plants. And then the mountain is saying that this plant works well on hillsides.
It smells wonderful out here. It looks like some sort of lily.
So this is called Sacred Datura, and it's in the nightshade family, which is the same family as tomatoes, eggplants. And this is such an interesting plant. It's actually a hallucinogenic plant, and it's...
Well, let's grab a few.
Yeah, maybe not. No, I would not recommend it. This is not one...
times are tough,
it's also highly toxic, so... but you can see, like, look at how big that flower is. This is a plant that will take zero water, and it's pollinated by moths, which is kind of cool, but, you know, just look at the size of that flower. It's basically my whole hand there.
So for the folks who want to plant something that is drought tolerant, that is native to Southern California, how do they start? How does someone start?
Well, there's a lot of things you can do to get started. One really nice thing from a monetary perspective is getting a rebate from the water companies. So there's turf removal rebates, and you can get actually paid by these water companies to remove your grass and put in a native plant garden.
Are they still doing that now?
The Metropolitan Water District and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power both offer rebates. So that can often pay for the whole conversion in itself with the savings you'll get on your water bill. And then, of course, you'll be saving water every month. But in terms of how do you get started, well, there are two main roads. There's the people who really want to roll their sleeves up and get into it on their own. Those folks typically will start by visiting a nursery, visiting us at Theodore Payne Foundation, visiting some of the other great native plant nurseries around the city, buying a book, and really importantly, I would say, is taking at least an introductory class. So we offer classes here at the foundation, everything from basics to maintaining native plants to designing your home garden. So there's a lot of good tools for the people who want to kind of go about it on their own. For those who kind of want a little less hands-on approach, you can hire professionals to help you create a native plant garden. Then there's a whole growing community of people who specialize in drought-tolerant and native plant landscapes. And we actually offer a list of professionals that we've kind of curated. So come ask us, and we're happy to share that list.
Evan Meyer, Executive Director of the Theodore Payne Foundation for Wildflowers and Native Plants. Evan, thanks for hosting us here today.
Thanks for coming out.
Well, back inside now, and people power is only one part of the equation for a successful garden. Those plants aren't going to pollinate themselves. Butterflies and other beneficial insects get the job done, but some of those species, especially the butterflies and moths, have dwindled in their numbers in recent years. Some have almost completely disappeared from the wild. Could that be changing? Paige Howorth is the curator of entomology at the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance, where she heads up what's best described as a fertility clinic for some of California's rarest butterfly species. Hi, Paige.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, I'm so interested in this because when I was out there in Sun Valley, we saw a monarch butterfly. It was flying around us. Beautiful species, obviously. There are now 18 critically endangered Californian butterfly and moth species, according to the state's Natural Resources Agency. How did we get here? I mean, what is threatening these populations?
Well, butterflies face numerous threats, and, you know, it's no surprise that climate change is one of them. Drought is obviously something concerning for California in particular. Fires, there are populations that could blink out if there's another major fire in the habitat where they occur. And there also are threats like invasive plants that outcompete the plants that the butterflies need to develop as caterpillars.
Well, we just spent some time exploring the native plants of California. So talk a little bit, Paige, if you wouldn't mind, about how native butterflies play a part in that plant landscape. And what's at stake if they stop coming, even in caterpillar form?
Well, I think that, you know, obviously butterflies are pollinators, and they're very important to the native plants that they are pollinating. However, their biggest impact is as food for other animals. Most people don't think about it that way because we love to see a butterfly fluttering off, but butterflies and moths are hugely important in ecosystems. Everything eats them at all life stages. Eggs, larvae, adults. So we're looking at the impacts not just to butterflies, but also to reptiles, amphibians, other invertebrates, birds and bats, and the list goes on. So they're really a critical foundation for ecosystems and really important to the transfer of energy through the food web.
I want to talk a little bit about the work you guys do over at the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance to save these rare species. What are some of their names? And do you have a favorite? Or is it like trying to pick among your children?
It is, kind of. I mean, but right now we're working with two species that are federally endangered. One is the Laguna Mountain Skipper, and the other is the Kino Checkerspot Butterfly. So they have really cool, interesting names. Easy to remember.
Right.
And we do what's called head starting. So we have head starting programs at the San Diego Zoo. And what that means is that we go out into habitats where there are known populations of these species, which luckily there still are for these two. And we collect females that appear to have already been mated and are already carrying eggs. We bring them back to the butterfly conservation lab at the zoo. And there we try to encourage them to lay eggs. I told that to someone recently, and they laughed at me and said, "Do you talk them into it? How do you do it?" But we have ways of, you know, providing substantial host plant, which is what they're searching for in their habitats to lay their eggs on. And that's what the caterpillars eat, and that's what they need to develop. So we give them no distractions. They are in an enclosure with just their host plant, and, you know, we feed them twice a day, and that's a pretty reliable method for getting a lot of eggs.
And that's the fertility clinic about what you do over there, right? That's that part.
That's part of it, yes.
How successful have you been?
Well, with the Kino Checkerspot Butterfly, we've been working on it since 2016. And at this point, we have a release tomorrow. So we're going to be releasing caterpillars into the San Diego National Wildlife Refuge. And I think tomorrow's release will bring us up to about 15,000 caterpillars released. So we're seeing them in areas of the refuge that we, you know, they haven't been seen for years and years. And with the Laguna Mountain Skipper, we just released them for the first time for 20 years almost.
Really?
Onto the Laguna Mountains. So that's where they get their name. That's
their name,
where they
yeah.
were previously from. And we just did a, you know, a reintroduction a few months ago of about 250 pupae, so different life stage that we're putting out there. So we're very excited about that because it's the first time they've been in the Laguna Mountains for more than 20 years.
When it comes to the monarch butterfly, there's a glimmer of hope, it seems anyway, for the population, because last year only 200 of them were counted in Pismo Beach, where they often stop. You know, this is their migration, right? Fall and winter migration. But so far, there's this story now that people have counted, I guess, in that region along the Central Coast, about 7,200.
Yeah.
Does that give you hope that, you know, maybe something's changing, or the climate is changing, and so we're just going to have fluctuations like this from year to year?
Well, I can't tell you how many excited phone calls I had last week about monarchs. It gives me a lot of hope. And I think, you know, what we're really talking about is resiliency of these populations. We know that we're living in uncertain times in terms of climate, and the climate is changing and circumstances are changing for these species. And so, you know, for monarchs, we've put a lot of effort into educating about the right types of host plant, using native milkweed instead of tropical milkweed so that we have migratory monarchs. And for other species, you know, these tools that we can use alongside other things like habitat restoration and managing threats of invasive species can make a difference. So yeah, I'm very hopeful. I think there's, you know, a lot we can do. We need to apply our skills. We need to apply our voices to the problems.
Is there anything, Paige, that you can do as a citizen, you know, like a citizen scientist to help? I mean, you heard at the beginning of the show, you know, over in Sun Valley, you can plant some milkweed, right, for the caterpillars. What are some other things that you can do in your garden with your native plants?
You can return your garden to a native habitat, and that's going to help pollinators, obviously, but it's also going to bring wildlife to your yard. You know, native species depend on native landscapes, and that's something that's really, really easy to do. As just one person. And you can also use your voice in your local government. I mean, there's a really cool example out there in Ventura where they revised their landscaping ordinance to include a requirement that new projects use 50% native plants and 8% pollinator-friendly plants. I think that's such a cool model that we could all follow. If we all advocated for those things, we'd see an increase in pollinator health and ecosystem health.
Paige Howorth, the curator of entomology at the San Diego Zoo Wildlife Alliance, she and her team are hard at work trying to save California's rarest butterflies and other special insects. Paige, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Steve.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
All right, moving on now with Greater LA on KCRW, and some renters are about to get some relief in Orange County. The Santa Ana City Council passed a law last week that'll prevent landlords from raising the rent more than 3% per year. It also gives renters stronger protections against getting evicted. That makes Santa Ana the first city in all of Orange County to have rent control. Gustavo Arellano is columnist for the LA Times, is here to tell us more about it for this week's KCRW Orange County Line. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola,
so the vote
Steve.
Just passed last week. Was it contentious? Did it pass easily? This is Orange County, right?
This is Santana, where you have an, I believe it's an all Democratic council, my council period. There's seven members in the council, and it passed by a 4-3 vote. And you asked about how contentious it was. Well, the meeting before the one last week, so earlier in October, three of the council members walked out in opposition to what was the inevitability of the four other council members passing this rent control law. And so it passed on 4-3. There was still contention, anger between the council members who were opposed to the rent control, and then the four council members were able to pass it.
There are two parts to this, right? The rent control and then the stronger protections against evictions. I want to start with you on the rent control. How does it work and who does it apply to? Is it like a certain year, things like that?
Yeah, we remember that California still has the Costa-Hawkins law into effect. In other words, that rent control cannot be put on any apartments or homes built after 1995. So that still applies in Santana. And also, as you said earlier, it's going to be capped at 3% per year. And ultimately, it actually, if there's landlords who want to say, hey, rent control shouldn't apply to my properties, they can actually appeal to the city manager, and the city manager is going to take it on a case-by-case basis. And at the same time, so it's supposed to start into effect actually next month and in a couple of weeks, actually. And every year, the city of Santana is going to say, okay, on their website, they're going to say, this is how much landlords can increase the rent by a particular year. And then in terms of protection, landlords have to tell renters now, any new renters on properties that are applicable, hey, this is what the law is now. And, they have to inform them of their legal rights if they want to evict someone. And the city's also going to create a fund to investigate if there's any wrongful evictions going forward. That's going to be in the hundreds of thousands of dollars.
The eviction protection, of course, something that we've been thinking about now for the past, 18, 20 months with the pandemic. I know that that's been a local and a national issue as well, Gustavo. And the issue of housing affordability is also huge here in Southern California. Orange County is no different. But not everyone, I guess we can agree that not everyone agrees that rent control is the solution, right?
Even the people who voted for it on the for the rent control on the Santana City Council said, like, look, this is something to help. The way to bring down housing costs, I mean, everyone debates about it. So, but one of the issues is we need more housing, period. We need, some protection or some funds to be able to get first-time homeowners to be able to to afford these houses more closely, easier. But at the very least, this is a way, according to the council majority, to be able to help people out so they don't get evicted and at least they don't have to pay as much. And of course, the critics of the rent control says, like, no, this is not going to help at all. This is just going to screw over those poor landlords who own these properties where they're making money off of them. Who will ever think about the landlord?
The issue obviously predates the pandemic, though, and folks in Santa Ana have been trying to get rent control passed for a long time. Is that accurate, would you say?
Oh, yeah. Remember, Santana is the working class city in Orange County, one of the most Latino big cities in the United States. So activists have been pushing this issue at least a decade and really for a long, long time. Santana is also one of the most overcrowded cities in the United States. There's areas of Santana that are as crowded as Manhattan. That's how bad it is. So this is a huge victory for them. It's not a perfect victory, of course, but this is a huge victory for them. And this is actually one of the first big moves by the current council majority. All four of them are burners. They all supported Bernie Sanders and they promised a more progressive city. And this is definitely something that falls into the Bernie revolution.
Anaheim, Irvine, Costa, I'm thinking of other larger cities in Orange County. Anybody going to follow suit on this? Is this the beginning of something big?
It's still Orange County. Orange County, of course, has long been ruled by developers, long been ruled by realtors. It's going to be tough. And this is the thing. There is no progressive council majority in Orange County besides Santana. I don't even think there's a Democrat majority because Anaheim, for instance, dominated by Republicans, even though it's a very blue city. Irvine, they do have Democrats, but, Irvine's Irvine. You think the Irvine company's going to allow rent control? Not in a trillion years.
Gustavo Arellano with this week's KCRW Orange County Line. Of course, he writes a column for the LA Times as well. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias.
That's all the time we have for today. Earlier, you heard about preserving butterflies and planting native plants. And I know the news about climate change can leave you anxious and worried. Me too, by the way. So here's something to make you feel better. There are people finding all kinds of ways to make a difference. Maybe you know someone who's doing things, big or small, to turn the tide. It can even be you. We'd love to hear about it. Let us know at kcrw.com/GLA. We're going to be talking more about climate change. We'd like to hear from you. Share your thoughts, how you're doing. Subscribe to the podcast. It's all at the website, kcrw.com/GLA. Tomorrow, the thoughts of a librarian who's seen so much change, ups and downs, in his 4 decades of service in DTLA. That is tomorrow with a new episode of Greater LA. Jenna Cagle, Catherine Barnes, Sonia Geis, Ray Guarna, Phil Richards, Mario Saavedra, John Meek, Amy Ta, Sue Margulies, and Christian Bordahl all helped put the show together this evening. I'm Steve Chiatakis. Thanks for your ears and for your time and attention. Have a great night.